Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2018, and I'm now here with one of my favourite guests from last year, Jason from No White Guilt. Welcome to back to Millennial.
Thank you, Woz. It is an absolute, positively magnificent honor to be back again with you and all your fine guests here on Millennial. It's just such a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. This one is even bigger than last year. I think it's going to total 72 guests, but by the end of it, we're at the halfway mark. Something I didn't say at the start of this evening is that this is day 8 of 15. So, I'm beginning to feel
Fatigue.
the fatigue
Yeah.
is trying to set in, and I am trying to resist it. We'll see if I'm able to come up with techniques to successfully resist it. Might involve a lot of fruit eating. I'm not sure yet, but anyway. Well, I've got these
Coffee,
bananas,
yeah. You have to do
coffee,
coffee.
caffeine, and yeah, so on. I've got these bananas waiting. They're supposedly they're good for energy. We'll see, but I am learning lessons for next year about different things that I should do differently next year to make it less, a bit more successful. But anyway, so far, the things the hangouts are not starting on time, but at least they are being made. One problem, of course, is that YouTube are not sending out notifications. They're bloody trying to sabotage this, and it's infuriating. But as I've said, 2 months ago, it looked like I wasn't going to be able to do it at all. So at least I'm able to do it. There is a lot of content being made, being generated. So, and I think it's relatively good quality content. So I am fairly confident about it. But there are always things that can be done better. Ah, now somebody just before we start, somebody's just asked, why is vertical politics removed from the schedule? Too edgy for Woz? No. He asked me to remove him from the schedule. It was already pre-recorded 2 weeks ago. So, no, it's not my decision. It was his. Sorry to disappoint you. People are always bitching. Anyway, okay.
Assuming,
Yeah.
endlessly assuming things, and always negative.
Yeah. All right. So, welcome. And
Well, thank
I'm very glad that you're here. And, one of the things that about last year's millennial is that it did lead to the after party. That's something I'm very pleased about. But in the meantime, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience? Because some of them might not know you.
Well, I'm sure that many of them don't. I'm still a very small fish in a great big pond. So I'm No White Guilt. You can find me over at nowhiteguilt.org. Woz was mentioning the After Party. That is a show that I have with my brilliant co-host, Jared of the Great Order, also known as the show is also known as Tap, and we do that on my YouTube channel, which is No White Guilt as well. You can find all the links to my social media platforms on my website. Again, that is nowhiteguilt.org. But before we go any further, I want to thank Woz for pulling off Millennial year after year thus far. Because this, if nobody has touched upon this yet, I think it's vitally important that Millennial greatly contributes to the formation of our pan-European community. This is important because by bringing us together, it makes us, even though this is virtual, it makes us a tangible community. And that is the beginning of culture. That is the beginning of family. That is the beginning of something far bigger than just a show or just some content production that somebody can make on YouTube. So this is something that, first of all, I guess I'm surprised but delighted that the anti-whites didn't shut down Millennial before it began. But the fact that it's still going is absolutely remarkable and delightful because this is luxurious in a way. We had him as a guest on Tap, and I pointed out that he was being shut down because of the power of music, particularly music that doesn't have any words. The music can serve as the soundtrack for our liberation, our redemption in our individual countries. And we are able in our individual countries to apply our own meanings and our own terminology, which best suits those circumstances. Therefore, the music is amorphous. It's able to suit it like a water take any shape it needs to take in any country to serve our ends. That is why they shut down people like Zurius. That is why I think that efforts like this, millennial, do incur a lot of anti-white resentment and antagonism because of the community building function that it serves. So as just saying that, I also want to say that I want to thank everybody who's listening and watching both live and in the replay today. Thank you for being a part of our growing family, this great white ring that circles the globe for white well-being. So I thank you all. You all are, and this is really important, you all are the best of our people. Too often we're told, our whole lives we learn that we are the worst. We are the wretches. We are the underbelly of society. This is what the regime, throughout all of their media organs, all their institutions of education, etc., this is what they tell us throughout our lives. But in fact, you are the best of our people. You are the best of your family. You are the best of your community. You're the best of your neighborhood. You're the best of your country. So I salute you all for being here. I specifically salute Woz for his service to our people. And I thank you for your service, Woz. As a token, actually, of thanks to Woz for his commitment and service to our people, I have a gift that I've put together for him and his audience here, all of you watching Millennial and outside of Millennial, just normal fans of Millennial Woz. What I've done is I've produced an exclusive reading of portions of my book called Prometheus Rising, which is a mythopoetic book contained in my book, Born Guilty, that I have just recently released. So I've given Woz the link to it. It's not posted on my YouTube channel. It is a gift to Woz and to all of you. You have to click the link to go and see it. You won't be able to find it otherwise. It's about a 5.5-minute reading. So don't do it now. Or if you do, be sure to come right back. But I want you all to have that. I'll leave it up for some time after the discussion ends so that you all can go and watch it then as well. So that is my gift to you all. And just know this. And specifically to Millennial Woz, a deep thank you for that. Just know this, everyone. What we are doing here is not quixotic. This is not a quixotic endeavor. This is not something that is impossible and we will never achieve it. This is something that we are making incremental steps toward every single day. And Millennial will be remembered as one of those big building blocks along the way, a big meaningful piece of that construction. And what I do when I think about what we are doing and what I am doing and have been doing with the work that I have set out for myself, the creation of my books and my dialectics, what I view it as metaphorically is akin to the construction of the Cologne Cathedral in Germany. I don't know how much you all know about this, but the Cologne Cathedral's construction, I think, went on for about 600 years or something like this. Now, there were stoppages in the work, but that's not important. What is important is that when they began the construction of the cathedral, they knew that they did not have the technology to finish their vision. They knew that the artisans didn't exist yet. They hadn't been trained yet in the crafts that they would need to be trained in order to execute and complete this vision. And nonetheless, they set out on this path to build this beautiful cathedral. And as sure as they thought those thoughts and spoke those words into existence, the science, the architecture, the engineering was eventually developed. The artisans were born and they were reared and eventually trained in the crafts that they would need to be trained in to complete that work. And they came to the work of the cathedral, and eventually it was completed. That is how I view what we are doing. We are going to make great strides while we are alive. We are going to make great strides and do fantastic things, but we don't need to solve all of the questions. We don't need to have all of the answers. Don't be blackpilled. Don't be pessimistic because we don't have all of the answers for all of these seemingly insurmountable odds that are arrayed against us. Don't be pessimistic because we are Western kind. There is nothing that we cannot do. Our heroes will come. They may be today those who will figure out the answers that to the questions that we might not be able to answer today or in the coming years. They may be in the wombs of our women today. Those little boys and little girls may be in the wombs of our mothers today. They will solve and finish the riddle that we have set out and made the biggest effort that we could possibly make during our lives. They will solve that riddle when they come to fruition in their adult lives. So keep that in mind. Don't let yourself be pessimistic. These are great times.
Yeah, and in a sense, we are all privileged to be living in these times, although it's often easy to forget that. You know, this is the thing about living in strange times, that it can be very negative, very onerous, very tiring, but it is also a certain honor, a certain privilege. Because, you know, after all, imagine living in a time where it wasn't possible to change the world. And, that is what we're doing now. In some small way for now, but enough that they're terrified of us. I mean, it's quite clear the establishment, the powers that be, are doing whatever they can to shut us down in plain sight and get away with it.
Well, precisely, and it's actually a fantastic turn of events. I know there is a lot of pain that is associated with what is colloquially been termed the shunting and this censorship, this omnipresent censorship. And we suffer greatly from this. We suffer from this economic terrorism when they go after us at our jobs, and this social terrorism when they go after us at our civic organizations, and this psychological terrorism when they physically threaten us. We've all, content producers, we've all received these death threats. That, of course, not only is the FBI going to not act on, or the federal law enforcement in every country not going to act on, but surely, pardon me, much less somebody like Twitter or YouTube going to act on. They couldn't care less. I know there's a lot of pain involved in that, but the reality is that they attack us because they know the power of our speech. They don't want to silence us because we have bad ideas. They want to silence us because if the public hears our ideas, the anti-whites know that they will lose control over the public's minds. That is why they have to shut us down. That is why they try to argue it into a moral act to attack us, to dehumanize us, to censor us. This is the reason why. And this hysteria that we see from them, this growing reticence, reluctance to bother with pretexts about why they carry out this censorship against us, is fantastic. Because now all of these scores of millions of average white folks who just bovine assent, nod their heads up and down to everything that the regime tells them to do, because as white people, it feels good to us to have order. As white people, it feels good to us to obey the authorities and maintain an orderly civilization. All of those white people, they see these double standards, they see the hypocrisy, they see the anti-whites acting out of hatred for our people, and that is eye-opening in a way that nothing we can say would ever open eyes. And that is why we have so many new people coming to the cause. That and our ability to communicate peer-to-peer. It's not just the fact that millennial woes can get up there and talk to many thousands of people every other night. It's not the fact that brilliant people like Mark Collette on This Week on the Alt-Right, a show that I am a co-host on, weekly, along with the brilliant Patrick Slatterly. It's not just that these people get out there and spread the news about what's happening to us. No, it's the ability to communicate with that other, you know, the housewife communicating with the other housewife in another country or another state, and they find out that they're not alone. That is what is so powerful. Discovering that you are not this anomaly. You're not this wretched anomaly, as you've learned over all of the years of your life by way of entertainment. But in fact, you are part of this sweeping, silenced majority, this massive number of people who agree with us, who can see everything that's taking place in the world and who are getting fed up with it. That's the real power. That's what they can't shut down. So censoring me, censoring you, that has an effect. But ultimately, even if people like us didn't exist, the simple fact of communicating across communities, across states, across provinces, across countries and continents, that in and of itself is undermining the anti-white narrative.
It certainly is. And you see that the complication is that this is an international movement of nationalists, which I don't know if that's ever happened before, actually. But the thing that unites us is that we are all derived from Europe, either directly or indirectly. And of course, it's very interesting because, you know, I always remember the 90s when there was much more of a divide than there is now. I really feel that white people are coming together in a way that they haven't for a very, well, maybe ever, actually. Because now we have, well, there are external rivals, let's say, who are in our territory and threatening our existence, frankly, whether they mean to or not, which is an important point to make. And so I think that there is an understanding developing between all kinds of white people that we have to work together. And at least we have to not obstruct each other as we have been so wont to do in the past. I wish more people were sort of getting this idea more rapidly than they are, because there are still stupid, pointless rivalries and mutual sabotaging going on. But I think that as time passes, that will lessen naturally. I think that people are going to become much less tolerant of that kind of destructive, belligerent behavior. And good. And, you know, millennial is an example of what can be achieved. You know, I mean, is it not better that we're all talking than, you know, all bitching about each other? You see, the trouble is, I've said it before, I'll say it once more, our enemies don't do this. They just work together and they just get things done. And we look for reasons not to work together. And it's just insane. But I think that is lessening because, well, more and more people are becoming aware of the gravity of the situation.
Without question. Absolutely, that is the case. And we are, the anti-whites are performing a magnificent service for Western kind in that we have, a long time ago, to our detriment, just by nature of the context in which we were in, by nature of petty-minded chieftains of our different groups, we broke apart. Once we defeated the monsters and the shadows around us, that includes disease, that includes wild animals, hunger, you know, sort of starvation, clean water. It also includes non-white tribes. Once we defeated all of this and secured our existence, we succumbed to petty chieftains and these pointless rivalries. And over time, these developed into kingdoms. And now we have these essentially sores that follow us from generation to generation, these memories of, remember when my ancestors fought your ancestors, and let's fire that up again pointlessly. We need to come together on the basis of our biospirit, the biospirit of Western kind, which it runs through all of us. It is a beautiful energy and music of our soul that contains all of our greatest geniuses. It manifests our Western civilization. It is the source of Western civilization. That is why the biospirit, that is why we produce Western civilization. The Asians have their biosphere. They produce Asian civilizations. We haven't seen the opposite take place. We haven't seen a group of whites in the middle of otherwise Western civilization suddenly produce an Asian civilization or something totally anathema to what everyone else around them was creating, or vice versa. So I write about this, actually. We could segue here on over to my book that I recently published, which is...
Let me handle that just for the sake of it, because this is the main thing that we wanted to talk about. On your previous millennial, you talked about two books that you were going to publish in actually quite close succession last year. I don't know what happened with those. Did you do that?
I did. Shortly thereafter, I published Go Free, A Guide to Aligning with the Archetype of Western Kind. And currently, that is, I am reworking that with a woman. And it will be available probably within the next maybe 2 months or so, the second edition. It's going to be fantastic. It essentially, we take the first one and we build it out some. Clarion is her name. We build it out some. We add some more of my dialectics to it, and I plan on making videos to help educate people. And in that book, I teach people how to overcome what I refer to as the meme pathogens with which we are infected, all of us in Western civilization, with which we are infected from our earliest days of our lives. As soon as we are able to consume information from our environment, we are receiving these infections. They pass into our subconscious mind, where they ultimately control our behavior. They control our thoughts about ourselves. Even when people like you and I, and others who care for white well-being and advocate for white well-being, even we are infected with these things. But what we have done, and this is what I help people do in the book, is I help them develop what I refer to as counter triggers, so that the moment the subconscious mind says you're evil for thinking that thought, and make no mistake, folks, your subconscious mind, no matter how much of a pro-white advocate you think you are, your subconscious mind, the moment you think something positive about Western kind, your subconscious mind tells you that you're evil, you're ugly, you're unfit, you're stupid for thinking such things. This is an infection. It rears itself repeatedly. It's like when you learn to ride a bicycle. You don't have to, at first, consciously, you think about the ride. You have to think about balancing. You have to think about pedaling. But eventually, that information is passed into your subconscious mind, and no more thought has to be paid for it. That is how lessons are taught. This is ultimately about brainwashing, that what the anti-whites have done to us. They've learned that seeding the ideas that they want you to imitate, we are an imitation species, into our entertainment is far more effective at teaching you how to behave and what to think than putting you in front of or putting before a teacher, a professor, and just having them lecture you all day long. So I teach people how to deal with this in a way that people like you and I and others in the movement have come to grips with and done automatically as a result of just trial and error. So when I hear that diversity is a strength, whether we're conscious of it or not, we immediately say in our mind, subconsciously it happens. Soon as subconsciously we hear that it's a good thing, whether we think it or it comes from the outside world, subconsciously we immediately think, no, diversity is strife. Diversity is disease. Diversity is difficult. The general public doesn't think that. Just look at their faces when they hear these things and when they hear contradictory ideas. I'll tell you
what, the metaphor that always seems to, it certainly works for me, it always seems very apt to me. And I think it's it works for other people. I think it sort of amuses them. Is transplants. Because, you know, if you get a body, a limb transplant or something like that, you have to take drugs to prevent your body from rejecting the transplant forever. Because otherwise, your body will reject the transplant. And even more interestingly, the transplant will reject your body. So, because they're innately different and they're not supposed to coexist. So, well, this is as I understand it, at least. Maybe I've misunderstood, but I'm pretty damn sure that this is scientifically accurate. At any rate, it's definitely sociologically accurate, because as we can see, diversity creates division, and you have to constantly do the anti-rejection indoctrination every single day. And even once you've successfully brainwashed one generation into accepting diversity, you have to then do it all over again for their kids. Because otherwise, the natural response will arise in every new generation. The natural response being, I want my own territory for my people. These are not my people. They shouldn't be here.
On to something that is a little bit more fundamental, even than our conscious thoughts. Biospiritually, we manifest what is inside of us onto our external environment, onto our world. Culture is the aggregate of each, say, individual white person's manifestation of our biospirit onto the environment. It takes slightly different hues given a number of factors. That's why we see slightly different varieties of Western civilization from country to country. But each one of us, as a member of Western kind, is assimilable to every other Western civilization. The problem arises when you have different groups of people with different biospirits, because we seek to have our, what is what we have internally, we seek to have that reflected back to us by our environment. So when we are in a culture that reflects who we are internally, we harmonize with that environment. When we are in an environment that does not reflect our biospirit, we are in disharmony, and that is uncomfortable. That is the discomfort you feel when you go to an all non-white area. That is the discomfort non-whites talk about when they are in our countries. So it's so fundamental. Even if all of the non-white peoples had the exact same IQ as we did, the exact same instinctual behaviors that we have, which I think is far more important than IQ, by the way, even if they had the exact same crime rates, the exact same disease issues, even if everything was the same and we just had a different bone structure and some different pigmentation, even if that were the case, if their biospirits were different, there would still be disharmony. And once that disharmony is great enough, once the competing groups that are in a particular context, once they all have this courage of numbers, then they begin to have this conflict, this arms race begins, this cultural arms race. And cultural arms races always end up in warfare. We've seen it throughout all of history. Only a cursory reading is enough for most bright people of history to see that that is indeed the case. So any in-depth reading of history demonstrates that indeed you end up with a cultural arms race, and eventually that turns hot. And one culture, which is to say one biospirit, ends up dominating the other. That has always been the case. So these are critical things for our people to understand if they are going to be able to make intelligent decisions in the world. Also, what's really very important about Go Free is that I teach people how to see and detect anti-white ideology in their environment, so that they the environment, the creations of the anti-whites, end up working to our benefit. Every new commercial, every new storyline that they produce makes those who have been awakened to this, those who are going free, that much more aroused, that much more attuned, that much more aware of what's being done. And the ubiquity of it, it ends up being and working in the end to our favor. That is what we have been missing for so long. I've been in the movement for a very long time, and I've been a good a good young person in the movement, and I obeyed my elders. And when they said, look, young man, this is the way you do X, Y, and Z. This is how we get from point A to point B. I obeyed. I made suggestions along the way. I learned from their errors. And I said, I think this is the way it should be done. I practiced on people. I practiced on my peers. And I developed a way that has proven itself to be very successful. And that is what I share in Go Free. So it enables people to empower themselves, to awaken themselves, to go free of anti-white ideology, and thereby to attain or at least begin to move toward their actual physical, mental, and spiritual potentials that are already sown into them. Because make no mistake, you are being undermined. You are handcuffed by anti-white ideology, whether you know it or not. The stress that is caused by these ideas circulating in your mind that you cannot get rid of. Once they are sown in, they are there. These ideas that you don't deserve to exist, that you are a product of an evil people, causes an immense amount of stress. And we know from our science that stress exacerbates all disease, and that stress can even cause disease by itself. So what effect is that having on our people ultimately? What effect is that having on them when it comes to their goals, their objectives, and throttling everything from their physical potential, what they want to accomplish physically, losing weight or what have you, having better health, to educational goals, and then all the way up to spiritual goals, their attunement and attainment with a higher spiritual knowing and a higher spiritual feeling with our environment. What is that doing to us? I submit to you that we are not even half the people that we think or that we are capable of being. You and I are not half the man that we could be, or half the men that we could be. The women out there, you are not half the woman that or women that you could be. We are not half.
I have to say, until I get fit, I'm actually about double the man that I could be. Sorry, I had to say that. But before we get on to Born Guilty, there is a communist in the live chat. So I'm curious about what you would say to this guy. Because he, after I did the thing about the transplant metaphor, he remarked, he said, get gulagged, Woz. And so I asked, are you not a fan? And he said, I am white. Capitalism is the problem, not people with a different skin color than you. So what do you say about that?
Well, first thing,
to a guy who then goes on to say that Lenin did very little wrong. So he's a proper communist. So what would you say to this guy who says that capitalism is the problem, not people with a different skin color than you?
Brilliant. Thank you for mentioning this person in the audience, because just let me clear my throat here. Because when you are a salesperson, the most important thing for you to understand is, and to know, is to who is and who is not going to buy whatever you're selling. If you're proselytizing your religion, who is and who is not going to sign up and become a neophyte to your religion? The reason why that's important is you want to be able to move right on to the next person if you know that the person in front of you is not going to buy or heed whatever you have to say. So when you approach someone, or when you're talking with someone, a colleague, a friend, someone in the audience, and they clearly are vehemently stupid, low IQ'd, utterly brainwashed, vehemently anti-white, any of these things are possible with these individuals. When you come across such a person, and they're clearly manifesting these things, they say outrageous things like Lenin did very little wrong. Assuming, of course, that this person is not just trolling us or what have you, it's not just some game for this person. If that's really where this individual's thinking is, move right on. Don't spend another second on that person. There are millions of white people out there that will heed the truth. There are millions and many more every single day come to the cause, and we can come to, I guess, no, a position where they're willing to heed those who are willing to speak the truth, who are willing to share data, who are willing to use logic, whose arguments you don't have to jump through mental flaming hoops to arrive at some conclusion. There are more and more people coming like that every single day. So I advise folks, if you come across a stooge like this, just brush them aside and move right along. This is like the braying of asses. When I hear anti-whites going off like this, when I hear them making a fool, to me, it's the squealing of pigs or the braying of asses. I don't hear any actual words coming out of them. They're animals that have been brainwashed to despise, if they're white, their own kind. If they're non-white, to despise Western kind. Move right past them. Of course, obviously, we can say about such an individual that there is a significant faulty understanding of history, that this Lenin did nothing wrong. If they perhaps don't know about this, what Lenin may have done, then maybe you could speak to that. Or if they do and they think it was acceptable, then you really have a monster on your hands, and absolutely spend no time on such a person.
Excellent. All right. So now that brings us to your new book, which is called Born Guilty. Now, I have seen, because you and I are friends on Instagram, and by the way, after my Twitter ban, which I'm not going to talk about, don't worry, but after that, I joined Instagram. Well, I think I'd already joined it in order to get the ID so that no one else could take it. I think I'd joined it ages ago, but I never actually did anything with it. And so I started, as a sort of substitute for Twitter, I started using my Instagram, and it is actually quite a fun website. It's completely different. I mean, you can't use it as a Twitter substitute because it's just not the same thing, but it is quite good. So if you're not sub to me and No White Guilt on Instagram, then go and do it. Now on Instagram, I first saw your the adverts for this new book, and it is quite a striking cover image. Is that photoshopping?
Well, it is. It was quite a bit of an effort to find somebody to do this. Every step of the way in the creation of this book has been arduous, and I went through five companies who said they were willing to make the cover. I explained what the cover would look like to them. These were companies that were competent and able to do this sort of material. They had done covers that were even more complex, so there was no problem there. Once they received the description of what I was looking for, they rejected me. Five different companies rejected and said, nope, we're not going to do that. I asked if it was a matter of money. And two of the companies, I told them that I was fabulously wealthy, which of course is far from the truth, that I could pay any price they wanted for the cover. And they still said, nope, we can't do it. My guess there is not that they had some sort of moral objection to the spectacle of a hurt child. These are people, you know, and it's obviously a fictional harm child. These are the same anti-whites who are willing to put actual video and actual photos of dead children lying on beaches. So they have no problem with that sort of thing. No, I think what happened...
Of course, but they do have a problem with photos of dead wee Swedish girls who've been torn in half by a truck.
Precisely.
It's so disgusting.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. Absolutely, it is disgusting. And of course, since they're anti-white, and everything that comes out of their mouths is a pretext to cover and justify the infliction of harm on Western kind, they have no problem then saying that, oh, the little girl who was killed by the Arab terrorist or what have you, Muslim terrorist, that is just too it's too graphic, it's too awful, we can't show it. And then the very next day, it'll be another dead Syrian child or something to carry out the wars that they want in the Middle East for certain groups of people. So I think what happened in these cases is these businesses, they just saw the power of that cover that I described, and they did not want white people to be seen as victims. They did not like the idea that, yeah, indeed, white people are born with us as anti-whites, deeming them as racists, as anti-Semites, and that this pictorially is far too powerful. They know the power of the picture. They know the power of how it relative rather to the written word, and so they just didn't want to do it. I was finally able to find an artist to do it. Obviously, I'm not going to say who he is and where he is and that sort of thing, where he came from. But we had to go back and forth. It was quite a little bit of a struggle there. But it finally got done. I think there's photoshopping. I don't know what else he was able to do there. But it ended up being my vision. So hats off to him. He did a superb job. It was in him all along, even though we had to go back and forth quite a little bit. But yeah, I'm very satisfied with the cover, and I've received a deluge of comments of people just loving the power of it. I'm very, of course, disgusted, and that's the idea. I mean, I want people to see the cover. I want whites to see the, particularly white women, to see the cover and gasp and say, no, not another brand on that little baby's sleeping baby's body. Yeah, and I think awful. that's what they're feeling when they see it.
Yeah, it is very striking indeed. So the cover aside, what is the book about? What is the purpose of the book?
Well, let me zip through some of these notes I wrote so that I don't want to. And you've got two more shows to do tonight, right? Yeah. Okay. Yes, two more shows to do. We're not going to keep Woes very long. We'll get through this quickly.
Let me see who's on after you. I can't recall. Dangerfield. Right. Okay. That'll be better. That's in an hour from now. That'll be quite different. We've got about another half hour.
Okay. Fantastic. So I'll say really quick. This is the culmination of 8 years of research, study, and writing that I did. It's some of the research was I'm a student, a lifelong student of human behavior. I studied subjects in that field for the purpose of this. I had to study storytelling since I wasn't formally trained in the field. I studied the top three religions to ascertain what the power where the power really lies in those religions. I consulted with scores of people. I hired and fired and worked with scores of artists in the creation of the book. I sought help from various types, from people within, a lot of great people within the cause helped me. So my hat's off to all of them, too many to name, unfortunately, right now. I meticulously, over these years, assembled all of everything that I had gleaned in the study and the research, and put it together and put it to the work for White Wellbeing, the dialectic tools that I assembled, put it all together into the book to serve White Wellbeing. I simultaneously wrote three versions of this book because I didn't know when I set out what was going to be the most powerful version. So I wasn't going to just let a version or an idea of the best route slip away. So I had three going on at the same time. Ultimately, it's experimental literature in several ways. I break the fourth wall in the text. I use all points of view. I use first, second, and third person, as well as first person present tense in the book. I use several voices in the book. I use casual, expository, persuasive, and descriptive when I speak directly to you as the reader of the book. I use a descriptive voice when I, in the two nonfiction essays you read in the book and a nonfiction novella. I use a descriptive lyrical voice in the fictional mythopoetic novella that is titled Prometheus Rising that you all will have an opportunity to hear me reading a bit of. Even though the book is not a graphic novel, it contains roughly 200 sketches in the book. Those sketches are in the places of the book where you are with me in my study, in my apartment in the Plains, Virginia, and they provide you a little bit more information, a little bit more context of where you are. There's also a unique device that I have built into the book that requires the reader to hold a physical copy of the book, and that is why there isn't an electronic version yet. I'm not going to reveal what that is, and if somebody does, I won't own up to it. Because I think it'll spoil it for the reader. So ultimately, Born Guilty is a frame narrative, which means that it has books within a book or a story within a story, stories within a story. In the beginning, you as the reader come to me at my home and apartment in the Plains, Virginia, and you stay with me for 2 days. I am your host. I am your guide during those 2 days. We take meals together. You dream during both of the nights that we are together, but I'm not always with you. When I'm not with you and I'm attending to other matters, you read from two books in my study. One is titled My Nation, My Fight, and the other is titled Prometheus Rising. The My Nation, My Fight is a book that I have unpublished. It's a book of essays and novellas that I have authored. The two essays that you read, there's one titled The Once Great City. It is nonfiction. Another one's entitled Institutional Anti-Whiteism. Again, nonfiction. The novella you read is called Crucible, and also that is nonfiction. Crucible is about my transformative years in junior high school, which in the United States is 7th and 8th grade. So roughly for everybody around the world, that's 11 years old to 13 years old. That essentially is an inspirational story. I talked about it a little bit on Last Millennial. I go into this school, innocent, 11-year-old. I begin asking questions about anti-white ideology. Why is it that everything we're taught and everything we learn is anti-white? And I finally am able to determine that the adults are not accidentally harming us, that it's intentional. That is when I dedicate my life to freeing our people of anti-whiteism and specifically protecting white children, children younger than myself at that age, from anti-white ideology. And I take a stand against the institutional persecution that I faced, the oral and physical persecution. Of course, I had non-white children come to fight me. I never lost a fight. So I eventually clothed myself in a Confederate flag that I sewed to the back of a jean jacket during the eighth grade year, and decided to take the fight to the opposition. I had wavered many times in that story, and I doubted myself, you know, because there was so much hatred directed against me, especially from the young girls, the young white girls. They wanted nothing to do with me. They made sure that I knew that I was banished from humanity for thinking these terribly unfashionable thoughts that white people, that we as children shouldn't be treated that way. The Prometheus Rising book is a fictional creation myth about the creation of Western kind. The story provides a narrative arc from the beginning of that point when we are created all the way up to the present. The book is allegorical. It's didactic. It's didactic on several levels, actually. There's a lot of thinking that went into every single element in Born Guilty. And by by saying that it's didactic on several levels, what I mean is to say that there is edification that can be drawn from broader and narrower elements of the story. So in the same portion of a story where a where something edifying can be drawn from a broader reading of that portion, there are also narrower pieces from which edifying lessons can be drawn as well. So to a degree, it's going to mean, the book is going to mean more or less to different people, depending upon who and what they are, perhaps their latent capabilities. Its story is mythopoetic, it's lyrical, and ultimately, just the gist of it is, it's about us. It begins with our maker in this story. Prometheus is our maker, the creator of the Promethean race, which is us in that story. Prometheus himself embodies all of our strengths and weaknesses. He's the first of many gods, so there are other gods that come after him. Some of these lesser gods produce, build, make, create some races of man or peoples of man in our despite, sort of in mockery of what Prometheus had done. And this establishes the context for the struggle that that you know sets the stage really for this conflict that wages its way throughout the totality of the text. So far, everybody that has received the text, and I don't know if anybody in the chat has already received it and they've already dug into it, and they
several of them are saying that it's due to arrive tomorrow, and they're quite excited about it.
Oh, well, fantastic. Thank you all for mentioning that. Please also, if you would, once you receive it, get a photo of it in your hand, on your desk, be creative. You know, I had Syrup, one of our moderators on tap, did a really creative photo where he's got, he put it, the book upside down and stacked them up and then took a photograph and then flipped the picture the 180 degrees so that everything that was facing down is now facing up, but now the title is right side up. Brilliantly done. Do that. Take a picture and then post it on Gab. Post it on Twitter. Post it on Instagram, these different places, Facebook, and spread white well-being. When people see this book, when they see the cover, when they see people excited about it, they will get excited and they will purchase the book, and it will spread like wildfire as a result. I have some ideas about how to market it, because we have to overcome, and it's going to be really a big group effort.
Before we get to that,
yeah.
Because you see, something that always fascinates me is the question of structure and the structure that is chosen for a particular piece or a particular project. It always really fascinates me that why does somebody choose, because it is a decision that has to be made, like, how should I shape this thing in order that to make it do the job that I want it to do as well as possible? What is the optimal structure for this thing? And it sounds like the book has a very unconventional and complex structure. And of course, the danger is that by making the form more complex, you obscure the content, because there's a sort of interplay between, if complex content, maybe a simple structure is better. Simple content, maybe a complex structure is better. What would you say about this?
Brilliantly said, actually, just brilliantly said. That is indeed the case, and that was one of the things that I struggled with. There were many questions when I began down this road. I think it was February 6th or so, 2011. And one of those questions was, how to convey this information in a way that will grip the reader and not let go. This very complex information that will also bring back a book, if you will. Books have been going out of style for a long time, and over these years, I've been carefully following what people have been using to read their books. And it went from regular books to Kindles and that sort of those sorts of e-readers. And now, predominantly, people are reading their books on their smartphones. And so I needed something more in this book than just another text. So
You wanted ability, something that couldn't be digitized.
Precisely. The ability to grab someone and keep them interested, keep them excited, had to go beyond just a great story, had to go beyond just a fantastic beginning, climax, and conclusion. So that was something that really took a lot of thought, a lot of careful engineering. When I was unsure about any element, I did a massive amount of research. I consulted with people inside and outside of the cause to see about, to get their opinions on it. And it's really something that we could, you and I, especially knowing that you are an artist, we could get together and have a show about to discuss, because the engineering, if you will, that went into the creation of Born Guilty is really... is really a colossal effort on my part. It was Sisyphean, the amount of time, the amount of study, the amount of consultations that went into it, moving pieces around, getting, and the worst part, as you know, as an artist, is when you get things the way you want them to look and you're happy with it, and then you discover some Achilles heel and you have to move it all away. You have to wash the board clean and start again. That was, at times, so many times I wanted to just give up. But it is this spirit within me that continues to just drive me. And I would, every single day I worked on this, I made sure no matter how sick I was, no matter how busy I was over these past 8 years, I was going to work on this book because I was going to bring this to fruition for the good of our people in the service of white well-being, so there wouldn't have to be any more suffering. I would at least do everything I could do to play my part, whatever that part's going to end up being, something tiny, something smaller than that, I don't know. But whatever that part is, I wanted to do it. I wanted to complete it. And I do believe that I've put something together that will help a great many people. I just have to sneeze really quick.
Yes, you're back. Oh, and you've switched your camera on now.
Yeah, my camera came on when I sneezed. I don't know what happened.
Oh, my God. Some kind of supernatural effect.
Actually, Woz, this is just for you. This is the very first time I'm on camera during a live stream.
Oh, yeah, I thought so. I've never seen it before.
Right.
Well, thank you. The elusive Jason shows up thanks to a surprise sneeze. Well, that's not what I would have expected to happen at any, if you'd ever asked me. Well, so the question was about structure, and I'm not sure what else to ask you about that, but it does seem that you felt that this was the best way to achieve what you wanted to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, we hear about these books, I mean, you've seen them, where these coffee table books, where it's not really something that is a great read, but it's something to lay out on the coffee table, perhaps because of the cover or the content of the, as far as like pictures, some short verbiage under the pictures, that sort of thing. But I wanted this to be something that in a way could develop into something that people really talked about. I don't want to say cult classic because there's some connotation there. Folk classic is the way I prefer to word it, but it's some sort of folk classic so that people would want to revisit this book again and again. They would want to go back. They would feel themselves a part of it. I specifically, when you pick up this book, when you start reading, you will find that the book begins, page one begins with an illustration. This is you coming out of the woods in this book. This is you coming to me in my home in the Plains, Virginia. And you come to my home, you enter my home in the Plains, Virginia. It's an apartment I lived in. It's a beautiful place. It's on another gentleman's property, a multimillionaire's property that I lived on at that time. And you come visit me. And when I finally come to you, when we are finally together, I acknowledge that you and I are together at that moment, separated by time and space, but we nonetheless are together, and that it is this ability to speak over this text, perhaps not only time and space, but perhaps there are even laws to prevent us from speaking, laws to prevent you from being with me in that space. I acknowledge that you can't tell me your name. You have no way to speak to me as you read that book. So I end up referring to you as reader, so that you have a name in the book. I acknowledge that while you're with me, your senses are going to be somewhat limited. I can't know every direction you're going to look. I can't know the things that you are most interested in, but I acknowledge it and I make an effort to empower you with the knowledge of where you are and what you're up to in that place so that you can understand that I don't take charge of you and your behavior while you're with me. I merely speak to you. I provide you information. It's a bit phantasmagoric with the sketches in that when you dream, you see snippets of where you are in the dream, and the snippet tells you everything you need to know about your environment. In the same way, you see snippets of the bookshelf, you see snippets of photographs, snippets of the architecture, and such. And this, by way of that information, empowers you to feel comfortable to be where you are. Now, of course, when we have meals together, we sit down, we do eat. I tell you what we're eating. I give you options to the best of my ability, because I know I can't know everything that you would like to eat or drink. I mean, there is no sommelier, for the gastronomes out there that want the finest cuisine or something. That's not there, because this is a bit more realistic. But as I say in this, so this draws the reader in. As I say, while I'm with you, we discuss stories from my history. We discuss that are all heuristic, that all serve to help you awaken, to go free to what's happening in the world. It's not like an immediate, I go straight to, here are the facts of what's going on. Here are the rape statistics. I don't bother with any of that. I'm talking directly to you in that portion, when you're with me in the study or when you're with me in the kitchen. But I'm not always there, as I said earlier. When I leave you, then I don't have control over you anymore. I can't tell you what to look at, or I can't show you what to look at or describe things. So at that point, you are reading from one of these texts in the room. Now, the texts also are interspersed with each other. So this is another tool, another device that I used to keep you reading, to keep you going. And with all of my trials that I've had, with all of my trials prior to printing and publishing the book for people to purchase, that is the way the mechanism worked. People wanted to keep going because not only did they say, well, these stories are page turners, but because they wanted to get to the next segment that they were reading from with a previous story. And then, as I say, I come back, I interrupt, the interruptions are briefly, we're together again. And then again, you're back to these segments and reading right along. You also, as I say, you dream on the two nights that you're with me. And of course, during your dreaming, just as you are not entirely in charge of yourself in the dreams, aside from those people who claim to lucidly dream, and then they make everything happen that they want to have happen in their dream, aside from those people, lucky bastards, aside from them, the rest of us are kind of just flies on the wall during our dream. We feel the horror, we feel the joy, or whatever it is, but we're just observing. And I take over your mind in those moments, perhaps a bad choice of words, but I take over the voice in your head during that time, so that you dream in the natural way that you dream when you go to sleep at night. So a lot of tools there. And again, there's a lot we can talk a lot about the sketches themselves and how sketches are able to convey this imagery is able to convey a lot more to you in that simple snippet of a sketch about who I am and about where you are than I could with words. It would take pages with words. But where this is really important, I think, is that our reader, the people who are going to be reading Born Guilty, the people who are reading all of the books, the great books that are being produced now and have been produced by our people, they are doing so from a position of feeling, as I say, that they're infected with these mean pathogens, and they're in this position that the author is somehow this troglodyte, this you know, this beast living under some bridge somewhere in some dilapidated home, you know, and dirty. How do we overcome that? Well, can you do that with just like an author's picture on the back of the cover or something? No, you simply can't. But what you can do is, if you can see my home, if you can see my pictures, if you can see the kinds of things in my house, you know that I'm not the troglodyte that you learned about those who care about white well-being. If you can see photos of me holding loved ones, if you can see the kinds of things I have, the learned study that I have in my home, you're going to know that my home isn't decked out with like weird animal skins from around the world, or you know, or what have you, whatever else it is. But yeah, this conveys an information of normalcy. And that is extremely powerful. At least I've gambled on it being so, and I've deduced that it will be so, and my fingers are crossed that it will be so for white well-being.
That's a very interesting description of what you've done. And as I said, the question of structure does absolutely fascinate me. And the use of pictures, I mean, obviously we have the phrase, a picture tells a thousand words and all that. Is often a very good technique. I remember, before I started the channel, I was working on a novel that also had a novella attached to it. And the novella was going to be done as a picture, like a picture book for grown-ups. So, mm-hmm. But it was going to have the beauty of a children's picture book. Like, you know, I kind of felt like, well, why shouldn't we have this pleasure of pictures and illustrations? You know, why don't adult like books for grown-ups ever? I'm saying grown-ups rather than adults, because I don't want the connotation of, you know, porn with adult pictures.
Yeah, right.
But why don't books for, you know, grown-ups ever have illustrations? Because it is nice and beneficial. So I was planning all this, and it was very exciting. It was a very creatively exciting project, and I was using only materials that I got for free as well, in order to create these illustrations. And I even built on the computer a sort of SVG. Well, I created a program in order to create the map. It was a lot of work, actually, because I couldn't find a thing that would do this. So I wrote a program in JavaScript to create the map of this town, which was then then converted into a 3D thing. And then that was going to be used as shots taken around that were going to be used as the basis for the illustrations that I would create by hand, IRL. Mm-hmm. So it was, but in order to get the proportions right and all that, I wanted to use this 3D model created from a 2D SVG thing. So it was all a lot of work. And then I started the channel, and all of that just fell away. And the main novel as well, which was a huge amount of work, and it was a really huge novel as well. I mean, it was like probably it'd be about 1,000 pages long, probably. I think.
Oh, wow!
It was really huge. I mean, because it was an undisciplined first novel, and I just threw everything into it, all of my concerns, I wanted to get something done. I desperately wanted an achievement before I turned 30. And so I thought, well, what can I do before I turn 30? It was like 6 months away. And I decided to try to do this novel. And I didn't actually make the deadline. but I did get a lot done before I turned 30. And then it grew again in the following year. And then this novella grew out of it as well. So I don't know. One day I really would like to finish these things, because it's like, there's so much work went into them, and it just seems such a waste. You know, the channel, I don't know what to do. You know, well, it's one of those big, huge dilemmas that I might resolve next year, but you know, I wouldn't hold my breath.
Well, no, that's extremely ambitious, and it would be a very exciting project to see you complete, see that come to fruition. But you have something. This channel and the Millennial has had such a salubrious effect for our people that I don't know that, you know, a book by itself, no matter how interesting it is, you know, no matter Born Guilty, for example, I don't know that it can have the same effect. I mean, I guess we can see, But hopefully you'll have time as you move forward to work on it. Just, I tell you what I, seriously, what I did was when I decided that this was going to happen and I just set my will upon it, there was no stopping me. I since I didn't have a channel to run at the time, as you do, I was able to say, look, every day after where actually I had two jobs when I started this. But what I said was every single day I'm going to work, even if it's just on it, even if it's just 30 minutes. So I made that commitment to myself, even if it's just 30 minutes, even if the kind of, pardon me, the work I get done during that 30 minutes isn't necessarily the most productive, it still kept my commitment. So there were days when over these past 8 years where I was sick with the flu and I seriously was on the floor with people talking about the book, taking notes, sick as a dog. And do it. So if you make the commitment that however much time you can spare with this channel, carrying this channel on, that you're going to work on it once a day or once a week rather, for an hour that day, sit down, really dedicate the time, then it will get done. See, that's the thing. That's magic about it. If you just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and every time that thought, and this holds true for our entire cause, everybody watching, every moment that the thought enters your mind that we're not going to get there, that the summit is too high off, and there are too many hazards in our way, too many things to overcome. If you just put your eyes back down on the ground right in front of your feet and put another foot in front of the other one and another foot in front of the other one, you will get there. We will get there. This is 8 years, not only of just writing a book, this is 8 years of research, of study, of writing three at the same time, of suffering major setbacks. And
could you hold that up for the camera, since we've got the camera now? There it is. Now, that is a shocking cover. I think you'll agree. But obviously, it is, don't worry, it's not real. It was Photoshopped. All and right. For anyone who's worried. But it is obviously done for a particular purpose. And but it sounds like the I'm sorry I interrupted you, by the way, but
no,
it sounds like the content of the book itself is not as disturbing as the cover would suggest, or is it?
Well, no, it's certainly not. I mean, there are no children being branded or the equivalent thereof inside the book anywhere. However, there are. It's not simply anodyne. By any means. I mean, when I'm talking in Crucible, where I'm talking about this transformative story of seventh and eighth grade for me, I mean, the sort of verbiage that the anti-white peers use against me is crass. So be prepared for the sort of verbiage that you hear from such people. In Prometheus Rising, there are great conflicts in Prometheus Rising. I mean, I have some notes here about the book. Of course, as it always goes, you know, the best laid schemes, O mice and men, gang aft the glay. So as soon as you write it down, a note, and you need it, it's gone. But somewhere, I mean, there are battles in Prometheus Rising, and so there are as graphic as your typical novel when it comes to battles, nothing gratuitous by any means, but you can expect the sort of speech that is commensurate with combat. But then there's also an immense amount of beauty and an immense amount of lyricism in that text. I wrote that in a completely different voice. You'll find in Crucible that it's a lot like written a lot like your typical novel. And it will carry you along, just like your typical novel will. The verbiage that I use, the actual not just the constructions themselves, the words themselves, but you know, both as they come together, they are the kinds of constructions that you, as a novel reader, will be comfortable with. You will notice; they will be familiar to you. Prometheus Rising might be a little bit more challenging to some folks because it's more lyrical, but you'll, as most have already shared with me, who have read it, they get into it. I had one of my editors, copy editors, who is not inside the cause, copy edit Prometheus Rising for me a couple years ago now. And he was, his doctorate is in, I don't know whether it's Old English or Middle English, I don't know what it was, but he wrote to me and said, where did you get your training in Middle English or whatever it was? And I said, I have no training in that writing. And he said, well, this is remarkable. I've never seen anybody write in this voice and carry it throughout the totality of the story. So in that, and you'll hear this when you listen to the little snippet that I put together as a salute to Woes and his audience, all the good people in his audience, that there's a lot of lyricism and a lot of beauty in the text as well.
Earlier on, you said about you were talking about the marketing. For a start, I've just posted the link in the live chat again. But for a start, how can people buy the book?
If they go to the link that you provide, they'll be able to watch that video. And the link for the purchase of the book is directly below it in the description. You can also go to my website, knowwhyguilt.org, and it is on the sidebar where you can find it to purchase the book. And of course, it's going to be on all of the descriptions of the shows that I do on Tap from now on. That's the After Party on my YouTube channel.
Excellent. And about the marketing, earlier on you said, before I asked about the structure, you were about to say that about the marketing, and you said it's going to be a group effort.
Well, this is an interesting thing. I mean, we are faced with, as everyone knows, some significant censorship. I think censorship that is the likes of which the world has never seen, because of the ability now of the regime to reach into people's lives. So we're faced with this, and at the same time, we suffer an absolute paucity of capital. And why do we suffer a paucity of capital? Well, we suffer it because every time an investor, if you have been a student of this movement, you find that every time an investor is known and who comes to support us, they are attacked by the anti-whites. They descend from all these stories of these like industrialists who began supporting nationalist movements and the like, and you know, many decades ago. And suddenly, all of their industry on every continent suddenly suffers strikes. Suddenly, the banks are calling on all of their loans. This is how the anti-whites function. So we have to find a way around it. There's no use in lamenting that we don't have the money. I mean, it's true, but there's no use in lamenting it. So we have to find a way. And I believe that way is going to unfold by way of a series of steps of launches and crowdsourcing by way of ideas, crowdsourcing by way of helping to spread the book and the information therein, maximizing people, asking people to step up to the plate when they can, in the ways that they can. There are people who can give a few dollars. There are people who can retweet. There are people who can regab. There are people who can post snippets of videos, asking them to do their little part. So there are going to be this stages that will unfold. The book is not going to have one launch. I see this first launch, if you will, as sort of to my family, to the immediate 10 or 1,000 people who are receiving this information, relative to even just my state here of Virginia, right outside the nation's capital. That is a very insignificant number of people, and so that is the first launch, if you will. The next launch will incorporate the crowdsourcing, will incorporate a lot of people, their efforts, their time, and we'll reach out to the larger white positive movement. Then we'll have other ideological launches and marketing. So we'll eventually reach out to the CivNats. We'll eventually reach out to the Cuckservatives. We'll reach out to these different sections. And we'll be able to do that. Oh, and by the way, there may also be, and probably will be, regional launches, state launches, maybe countrywide launches. So there'll be that as well. But speaking to the marketing, one of the many elements that is sewn into this book is the knowledge that it has to be marketed to people in all of these different ideological sectors. So I have prepared the book for that purpose ahead of time. Now, the way the human animal normally works is that we endeavor to do something, and the rest of it is really aleatory. So, pardon me, you have to buy a lottery ticket to win the lottery. But buying the lottery ticket isn't going to win the lottery for you. You have to try to be an engineer, to eventually be hired as an engineer and maybe end up being a multimillionaire engineer, but being trained as an engineer isn't going to make you an engineer. The rest of it is really, I'm not going to call it luck, but it's chance. It's mathematics. This is how the universe works. So what happens, though, is you end up with people who they get trained, and then they have success, and then they go back and say, okay, everybody, the reason why I had success is because of I did all of these different steps in the beginning, when in truth, they didn't do any of that in the beginning, knowing that they were going to end up where they are today. They just went back and said that I did all that because it makes them seem brighter and it enables them to sell you a bill of goods, potentially. You see a lot of this in the self-help community where they say, you want to become a millionaire? Do what this guy did. Well, you can't have the same chance that he had. You could take the same guy in a parallel universe, if you would. This is just for, you know, there is no such thing as a parallel universe, but just for argument's sake, you could take that same exact scenario, and if he didn't have the success, it didn't have the moments of opportunity that he had in his life would have been totally different. I know a multimillionaire who got his opportunity to become a multimillionaire, and one step followed the other after the other, because of a colleague who got into a car accident on his way to work one day. The guy was on his way to work, got into a car accident. He needed months of rehabilitation. This individual was asked, hey, can you slide over to this position temporarily? He did. He moved over to that position. And a few weeks later, they needed somebody in another spot. So they moved him to another spot. And it was one domino after the next. And yes, he had the training. Yes, he was able to make the most of these opportunities, but nonetheless, they were opportunities. Having said that, it is an act of, I don't know, maybe audacity to attempt to achieve what we normally do, what we normally claim to be able to do when we have success. And that is to write the script for that success prior to it happening. And that, at least when it comes to marketing, is something that can be done. I can't be sure that the book is going to do fabulously. And whatever, however we define fabulously. But what I could be sure of, and in an example that we're talking about here, is that the book will have elements in it that will enable me and enable those who want to serve white well-being and spread this message to others out there, to all of our brothers and sisters, will enable us to create the marketing that is tailored for the specific groups. So that is already sewn into the text.
All right. So it's obviously a very complex process, and both the creation and the marketing and the sort of afterlife that you envisage for the book. So I think we should leave it at that, because for a start, I've got somebody due on in 15 minutes. But it does sound fascinating, and I feel like I'm cheapening it by ending the discussion here. But I sort of have to, so I apologize. No, I'd like honestly to keep talking about this and see some of the illustrations and so on. But
next time,
yeah, we can't do it just now. So there are super chats, and another person has just reminded me. Well done, thank you, Lantis. Now, okay, I'm going to refresh this page so that we'll see that. In fact, I've got them on Skype. Right. Excellent. Okay. Now, I don't know whether to read out people's names when I read out the Super Chats, because, of course, it might be their real names. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. But in fact, I'll just not do that. So somebody said for 20 euros, someone said, hail our people. And I'm sure that there aren't many people who'll disagree with that message. Pen O'Shea. Pen. yeah. Okay. Said, Merry Christmas. Thank you. Merry Christmas. JK160, I'm pretty sure that's not his real name, said, support Woes and no white guilt. Thank you very much.
Amen.
And then and he also said, Crucible is awesome. Reminds me a lot of what my time was like in middle school. Prometheus Rising is a lot like Lord of the Rings or Paradise Lost. Extremely mm-hmm. exciting book. So this sounds like somebody who's read Born Guilty already. Mm. And then someone else says, keep up the good work, Jason. Balboa says hello. I don't know if that means anything to you. We must never forget we should be white men of good character. Then someone else says, great to actually see Jason. So maybe you would consider this in future. I don't know. And then someone else says, and obviously this is someone else saying this. It's not me. I'm just going to read out the words quite dispassionately. They say, that's what you look like. Sexy. And then someone else says, gentlemen, would love your thoughts insofar as the potential of the skillful use of the English language to stir the souls of our people to action. What place do writers have in our movement? Now, I've got a big thing about, I don't think that art should be expressly political. I think it should be more human and cultural, spiritual, psychological, and so on. And the politics can flow from that, which is, it sounds like that's what Born Guilty is like as well. So I'm not sure about this. What would you say? What's your opinion on this, Jason?
Well, specifically to the use of verbiage in our art, is that what he's getting at?
He's just saying the potential of the skillful use of English to stir the souls of our people to action. So he's, what place do writers have in our movement? I mean, clearly, we live in an internet age, and video and picture image is very important, but so too still is verbiage, is Latin written oral language, verbal language. So clearly that it's going to have a place, and the more adept you are with language, the better. So, and I'll tell you this, I do think that practice improves. There are people who aren't naturally that articulate who can improve their articulacy, their verbal dexterity, simply by speaking and writing. I think actually part of the reason that I was more articulate in the first few years of my channel is that I had just written a novel. And once that sort of faded away, I became more hesitant, and I wouldn't be able to find the right word. It's still affecting me now, actually, but perhaps also because I've made so few videos recently. It definitely is something that you've got to maintain through through using it, basically.
Yeah, precisely. I would caution. Now, let me first say, there is a lot of room left for the written word. It's not going anywhere. The place that it's read may be changing, and this might be something that becomes sort of cyclical. So it might not be linear. We might not be moving away from tangible books to e-readers, to cell phones, and then that's the end of time. There may well be a circle back. In fact, I imagine there will be. So the strength of the spoken and written word is extremely important. But I will caution that Woes is, folks, is very articulate. He's got a large vocabulary, but sesquipedalian words, to really put the meaning to this, sesquipedalian words are not necessarily going to be the words that people are going to resonate with. They're not going to know what they mean. This was really hard for me. This was something that I cannot tell you how difficult it was with Go Free, because I wrote this book. I thought it was perfectly understandable. And I sent it to the first person to copy edit, and they got back and said, well, these words are pretty obscure. People don't like it. So I thought, okay, I'll yank them. And then the next copy edit, and they said, well, these words. So it got down to the point where, I started off okay with taking out words that I thought were interesting and useful, all the way down to where the text had really changed so that it would be accessible to the majority of people. So the important thing here is the construction of the sentences, the construction of the ideas, how you deliver those ideas, more so than the words you use. So I know a lot of people think, well, I've got to find the perfect word that encapsulates all of the meaning of whatever it is they're trying to convey. But in reality, if you find that word, if you hunt it down and you find that word, and especially if it sounds fantastic, it's not going to be the word that's going to resonate with anyone that you get that message out to. It's just going to be too obscure. So focus instead on creating constructions that are useful. The way a sentence is assembled, I had no education in storytelling. I was just autodidactically invested my time in finding out what it means to be a proper storyteller and what it means to properly construct sentences that people can understand and appreciate. And for whatever reason, my dedication, my aptitude or whatever, I was able to learn a lot of different types of constructions. You'll see them in Born Guilty. You'll also see them in Go Free, these different types of constructions. But it depends on what you want to write. If you want to write a novel, learn that type of construction, sentence construction, and master it, and then bring that story to our people, just as Woes is saying. Bring the story. You don't have to start off, you know, chapter one with a group who is working on building the wall to keep the migrants out. Okay, write a story that has feeling, that's about a family, that's about an individual, a protagonist that people can identify with. And in that world, you have these political things taking place. In that world, you have these characters that everybody likes in your story acting in a way that is white positive. That is how you convey the message. That is how the anti-whites have done this to us. They didn't come forward and say, everybody go vote for these anti-white outcomes in their literature. They came forward and they said, here are the good people. Here's how they behave. Here's the ideas they endorse. Here are the bad people. Here's how they behave. Here are the ideas they endorse. But I have to say, I've had an absolutely tremendous time. It's been fantastic. First time on camera for a live stream with Millennial Woes. I want to mention that, of course, Tutar is on Wednesdays at 2 Eastern Standard Time with the world-renowned Mark Collette, the sage Patrick Slattery. TAP, which is the after party, usually on Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with the brilliant Jared of the Great Order. If you have not seen his appearance or Mark's on Millennial, please go back. They're earlier in the Millennial. They both did fantastic jobs. Please go and check them out. Tomorrow night, I will be on with JF at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So please do that. Go have a look at that when I'm on with JF. Otherwise, it's been a fantastic time. Let me just say to everyone, Woes, and let you have the final thought, that I send my love to all of you. A Merry Christmas, a Happy Yule. We are a growing family. The speed of our movement is growing. The energy of who and what we are is growing. At times it seems like there's a miasma. At times it seems tough. At times it seems like the enemy has the anti-whites, the victimizers, like they have all the strength. But we are those who are fighting for what is good and virtuous and noble and heroic. And let's do this. Let's make 2019 the first year of the Western sunrise. Godspeed to all of you. Thank you, Woes.
Thank you very much, Jason, from No White Guilt. But just before we leave, another super chat. What are your opinions on Red Ice? Oh, I love Red Ice. I love Henrik and Lana. They're two of the best people I know. And whenever people badmouth them, it just annoys me so much because I know how hard Henrik and Lana work. And it's, you know, I just have nothing but admiration for them. Mm. Another person, endless gratitude. I love you both and nearly everyone in the live chat. Stay comfy, fam, and happy millennial. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. That's that. So we'll end it here. This has been a really good live stream. And, it's been great. Well, in my opinion, it has.
Please come appear on TAP the first chance you get. We had you appear one time before. It was a fantastic episode. We'd love to have you back.
The British episode was good. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So great to have Jason back for from it was one of the most popular last year. This was a great one. I think this went on much longer than usual, but I think it was worth it. I think it was interesting and excellent. So hopefully we'll all still be here next year and we can do this all over again. Excellent. So thank you, Jason, for taking part in Millennial 2018. Thank you to everyone for listening. I will be back in about 10 minutes with Chris Dangerfield. So I look forward to that. I hope you are too. I'll see you then. Thank you for watching.